Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter. On today's show, we will hear about the outbreak in South Korea of the disease known as MERS. As of Friday, 4 people have died in that country from Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. However, we will take a moment to define some important health-related words in this story. Quarantine means to keep a person or animal away from others to prevent a disease from spreading. Acute is an adjective that means very serious and dangerous. And respiratory refers to the process of breathing. The first 2 victims were a 71-year-old man and a 58-year-old woman who died of acute respiratory failure. Acute respiratory infection prevents the body from getting oxygen and can result in death. Tests showed both patients were infected with the MERS virus before they died. On Friday, health officials in South Korea confirmed that 2 more people had died of the virus. All the patients in South Korea have been numbered and their exposure recorded. The first Korean patient diagnosed with MERS was a 68-year-old man. This man, called patient number 1, returned to Seoul from a trip to the Middle East in May. After feeling sick, he visited 4 hospitals before he was correctly diagnosed. Health Ministry officials say patient number 1 was a super spreader. This super spreader is suspected of infecting 28 of the confirmed MERS cases. Professor David Hui is the director of the Stanley Ho Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases in Hong Kong. He says a super spreader is someone who has all the right conditions to carry the disease. The number of people infected is rising. Health officials in South Korea have confirmed more than 40 people have the MERS virus as of Friday. At first, these officials thought that all of the MERS cases came from the more than 1,600 people currently quarantined. That does not seem to have happened with at least the 2 latest cases. South Korea's Ministry of Health released the name of a second hospital where MERS was found, but so far officials have refused to release the names of the other hospitals where MERS patients are being treated. Hong Kong's Professor Hui disagrees with South Korea's decision to withhold this information from the public. During Hong Kong's experience dealing with the SARS outbreak that began in 2002, he says, they learned that sharing as much information as possible is the best way to reassure the public. I'm Mario Ritter. You are listening to the VOA Learning English program, As It Is. We're back with a report on Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. In the first part of today's show, we talked about the recent developments related to the MERS virus in South Korea. And now, here is Jonathan Evans and Anna Mateo with more about MERS.
A man named Kwon Jun-wook is the director of South Korea's MERS management team within the Ministry of Health and Welfare. He says the person known as Patient One was a 68-year-old Korean man. He became infected in May after returning to Seoul from a trip to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates.
Mr. Kwon adds, the South Korean government is now in the process of barring travel by anyone exposed to the virus.
VOA's reporter in Seoul says most people do not appear to be taking steps to guard against MERS. He says South Korean workers and other people are going about their normal activities.
However, the country's tourism industry may be affected. The Korea Tourism Organization estimates that about 2,000 Chinese and 500 Taiwanese have canceled trips to South Korea. Tour operators expect more cancellations if more cases of MERS are reported.
One visitor from the United Kingdom, a woman named Leanne Creasy, says the risk of getting MERS in Seoul is not nearly as great as the media is making it seem.
I don't think there's been that many cases of it here, and also, like, I don't feel like just because there's a lot of media coverage or something that I should necessarily believe that it's going to be that dangerous.
Besides tourism, schools have also been affected. The Ministry of Education has canceled classes in more than 200 schools. Most of those schools are in or near the area where a woman died from the virus on Monday.
Kim Woo-ju is a professor of infectious diseases at Korea University. He is working with the government to contain the spread of the disease. He says wearing a mask over your face, washing hands repeatedly, and covering your mouth when coughing should be enough to prevent infection.
The MERS outbreak in South Korea is the largest outside of the Middle East. There is also one reported case in China.
The MERS virus can produce symptoms or warning signs like those of another virus, influenza. The symptoms can include higher than normal body temperature and coughing. These symptoms can progress to pneumonia and kidney failure. There is no known cure or vaccine for MERS. Over 40% of people infected die from the disease.
The MERS virus was discovered in Saudi Arabia in 2012. The World Health Organization says the virus likely came from camels in the Middle East. It is unclear how MERS passes from the animals to human beings. But the virus spreads between humans by coughing and by direct contact with fluids from infected people.
MERS is related to the common cold and SARS, the severe acute respiratory syndrome. 10 years ago, a SARS outbreak in China, mainly in Hong Kong, infected over 8,000 people and killed nearly 800. The World Health Organization says there have been over 1,000 MERS cases worldwide, with at least 400 related deaths. I'm Jonathan Evans.
I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Our word today is maverick. A maverick describes a person who thinks independently. A maverick refuses to follow the customs or rules of a group to which he or she belongs. In the U.S., a maverick is often admired for his or her free spirit, although others who belong to the maverick's group may not like the maverick's independent ways. But where did the name maverick come from? Early in the 1800s, a man named Samuel Augustus Maverick moved to Texas from the eastern United States. Texas was a place of wide open land, rich soil, cattle ranches, and cowboys. Actually, it still is, but back then it was even more so. Samuel Maverick had just completed law school. He settled down in Texas and became an important landowner and a politician. In fact, he became mayor for the city of San Antonio. As the years passed, Mr. Maverick added to his property in Texas. Before long, he owned huge pieces of land good for raising cattle. But he had no cattle. He wasn't a rancher. One day, a man came to Sam Maverick to pay an old debt. But the man did not have the money he owed. So he offered Mr. Maverick 400 cattle. Mr. Maverick accepted them, but he didn't really want them. He simply turned the cattle loose on his land to eat and care for themselves. It was not long before the cows reproduced. The calves grew and had more calves. Soon, hundreds of cows and calves moved freely across Sam Maverick's land. They also moved across the land of nearby ranch owners. It was a tradition among ranchers in the West to put a mark of ownership on newborn calves. They burned the name of their ranch into the animal's skin with a hot iron. The iron made a clear mark called a brand. Brands allowed ranchers to easily see who owned which cattle. Sam Maverick refused to brand his calves. "Why should he?" he asked. "If all the other cattle owners branded theirs, then those without a brand belonged to him." And this is how the word maverick got into the American language. It meant a calf without a brand. As time passed, the word maverick took on a wider meaning. It came to mean a person who was too independent to follow even his or her group. Sam Maverick was a maverick in two ways. It was his name, of course, and it described his decision not to follow the tradition of ranchers to brand their cattle. Sam's grandson, Mari, was also a maverick. He was elected to Congress in 1935. Mari Maverick was a member of the Democratic Party. But he was an independent thinker. As a congressman in Washington, he refused to follow his party. In fact, he led a group of progressive Democrats who also disagreed with party leaders. His group was called the Mavericks because it refused to wear the Democratic brand. Besides politics, you can also find Mavericks in popular culture. The Mavericks is an American professional basketball team from Dallas, Texas. In the 1986 movie Top Gun, Tom Cruise's character is a fighter pilot named Maverick, who plays by his own rules. And a sporty car called the Ford Maverick, popular in the 1970s, has a nameplate that looks like a cow head. Now, the word is also becoming a popular name for boys in the U.S. In fact, Maverick is my son's middle name. You have been listening to the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Shirley Griffith with People in America in VOA Special English.
And that's the way it is. And that's the way it is.
For almost 20 years, that was how Walter Cronkite would end his newscasts. Americans all knew him. So did many world leaders. Today's news anchors could only hope for such recognition. He was often called the most trusted man in America. He anchored the CBS Evening News until 1981. The 60s and 70s produced more than enough stories to fill a daily newscast. Those were years of social change and civil rights protests. Years that saw John Kennedy, his brother Robert, and Martin Luther King all murdered. The war in Southeast Asia expand. A president resign. Years of worry that the same rockets that could take people to the moon could also bring nuclear war to Earth. And years when most of us still thought of a mouse as a small creature. Yet smart minds were thinking up the technology behind today's computers and the Internet.
Walter Cronkite brought it all home each evening, Monday through Friday. As President Barack Obama said in a statement, he was there through wars and riots, marches and milestones, calmly telling us what we needed to know. And when the anchorman was not in front of the camera, there was a good chance he was on his boat. He went sailing up until almost his final days. He died on July 17, 2009, at the age of 92.
Walter Cronkite was born on November 4, 1916, in St. Joseph, Missouri. His father was a dentist, his mother a housewife. With young Walter, the family moved from the Midwest to Texas. He worked on his high school newspaper and later left the University of Texas at Austin to become a journalist. He was a newspaper and radio reporter and sports announcer. In 1940, he married Mary Elizabeth Maxwell, known as Betsy. They had three children and were together for nearly 65 years until Betsy died in 2005.
As a young reporter, Walter Cronkite covered World War II. He worked for United Press, the wire service which later became United Press International. He landed in Holland with American soldiers in a glider. And he was in a military plane overhead as Allied forces stormed the beach at Normandy, France. It was June 6, 1944, the start of the Allied invasion of Europe, the final push to defeat Nazi Germany. Later, Walter Cronkite reported on the trials of Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, Germany.
One day during the war, the famous journalist Edward R. Murrow offered him a job. It was a chance to report for a major television network, CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. Yet TV was still young then. Walter Cronkite decided to stay where he was. United Press raised his pay and later made him its chief in Moscow. But in 1950, he accepted another offer and went to work for CBS. One of his early programs was a history show where he questioned actors playing people like Aristotle and Joan of Arc. But he was a serious newsman, and in 1952, he led CBS coverage of the National Political Conventions. They were the first to be televised coast to coast.
10 years later, on April 16, 1962, he became anchor of the CBS Evening News. The program was only 15 minutes long then. It took him 2 years to get his wish to extend it to 30 minutes. He also became managing editor, which expanded his influence over the program.
Well, I participate very directly in the entire process, in the decision of what stories we cover, decision on how we're covering them, what length of time we're going to give to them. It's a continuing process. I write part of the broadcast. Every bit of copy that goes on the broadcast passes through my hands. I edit every word that I say. I say no words that have not gone through my hands, many of them my own.
Walter Cronkite met some of the most important people of his time. This was the time of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. In one interview, though, he asked President John F. Kennedy about another conflict that was growing then.
Mr. President, the only hot war we've got running at the moment is, of course, the one in Vietnam.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there.
Americans would come to find truth in Kennedy's words, but just 2 months after that interview, shots were fired at his open-top car. As we will hear later, Walter Cronkite had the sad duty of reporting that the young president was dead. Happier moments came as he reported on the American space program. In July of 1969, he was almost speechless when Neil Armstrong became the first person to walk on the moon.
Oh, boy. Boy.
Walter Cronkite rarely expressed his own opinions. That was not a reporter's job. But in the late 60s, he went to report on the war to prevent a communist takeover of South Vietnam. President Lyndon Johnson and his advisors kept telling Americans that the United States was making progress. Walter Cronkite went to see for himself. Then, in a commentary in February of 1968, he said the war seemed unwinnable.
It is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate.
Some people denounced him and questioned his loyalty. Others praised him for speaking truth to power, as some might say. Several weeks later, Lyndon Johnson surprised Americans and announced that he would not seek re-election. The unpopular war had cost him support.
It was Richard Nixon who brought home most of the troops before South Vietnam fell to the North in 1975. But it was also Nixon who became the first and only American president to resign. Americans learned from the press that there was political corruption in his administration. Night after night, millions turned to Walter Cronkite for the latest developments. There were other anchors and other networks, but people thought of him like family, Uncle Walter. He anchored the CBS Evening News for 19 years. He was 64 when he stepped down on March 6, 1981. But he explained that he was not leaving the network.
Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6, 1981.
Now, Steve Ember looks back with a personal story about Walter Cronkite.
I remember the afternoon of November 22, 1963. I was a first-year student at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and was relaxing between classes at the Student Union building. A TV was on. My eyes were elsewhere, but my ear was caught by the unmistakable voice of Walter Cronkite.
Bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The first bulletins coming in from Dallas were read by Cronkite over the CBS News bulletin slide.
More details just arrived. President Kennedy shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh no."
Before long, though, there were pictures, with Cronkite at his desk in the CBS newsroom in New York. For so many of us, the presidency of JFK represented a time of promise. This could not be happening, was the sentiment expressed as a growing crowd gathered around that black-and-white TV set. And Walter Cronkite, in measured tones, informed us that, yes, it was. What I'll always remember was seeing him about an hour later momentarily take off his thick, dark-rimmed glasses and announce,
"From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago."
You could see the flash of emotion as Cronkite removed and replaced his glasses and regained his composure.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
But going beyond this trusted anchor's solid presence in delivering such news, you have to know something about television news in that era. There wasn't the clutter of crawls, flashing graphics, or other moving stuff that we see today. There was Walter Cronkite, in shirt sleeves, with a microphone in front of him. That was it. Nothing to distract the senses from the message. It was up close and very personal. It was not long after the Kennedy assassination that I actually got to meet Mr. Cronkite. He was anchoring live coverage of the 1964 Maryland Democratic primary election, originating in Baltimore. I was hired in a minor role on the CBS production team for that night's broadcast. I can't say I remember all that much about the experience, other than it being very fast-paced. But what I do remember was, at the end of that long, continuous coverage, it must have been about 2 a.m., Cronkite sat down briefly with us production functionaries to chat. I could not begin to tell you what we spoke about. It was enough to be in the presence of this great anchor I so admired, and to realize he was not above having a beer at the end of a very long broadcast with low-level support people. That was the sort of thing that made a young man with broadcasting stars in his eyes glow in the dark. I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. Our program was written by Geraldine Watson and produced by Dana Demange. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for People in America in VOA Special English.